Hello, everyone. Welcome to Random Encounter 291 or 291. My name is John O'Logan, and at RPG Fan, we try to celebrate RPG fans in all of their forms. So for many folks, JRPGs are the default, which is, you know, what they grew up with on console. So in that case, it might be Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest, Lufia, those kind of games. And for others, they may have grown up with CRPGs on PCs like Baldur's Gate, Fallout, games like that. And then for others, they may have loved SRPGs like Ogre Battle, Tactics Ogre, and Shining Force. However, there is one extraordinarily long-running RPG series that has a unique gameplay system different from all of these examples, and you might not even realize that it exists, and that is Spike Chunsoft's Mystery Dungeon series. So if you know this, you're going to be rolling your eyes heavily. If you don't, your mind might be blown in a few minutes. So this is a series that has been running continuously since an entry on the Super Famicom in 1993, but because of limited Western releases and a unique way of releasing the titles and the topic, the subject matter of the titles, you might not even realize that this series of games is a series at all. You might have played some of them and not realized it was a series. But now there's a brand new entry in the long-running Mystery Dungeon series, Shirin the Wanderer, the Mystery Dungeon of Serpent Coil Island. It was just released, and we have Ben Love here to talk about it. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Jono.
Yeah, and even more than that, even more than this review, Ben is also currently working on a new game primer. We have a few game primers, so you want to get into. I wrote the one on Yakuza in association with another gentleman on the site, and there's a bunch of them on there. And there's going to be a brand new one, so you want to get into the Mystery Dungeon series. So since you have this feature almost written and because you have this review, I thought that we should use this episode to take a reasonably deep dive into the Mystery Dungeon and collect as much treasure as we can and try to get out alive. Sound good?
Yeah, it sounds great. I'm excited.
Cool. All right. So, giving everyone a little bit of background about this, Spike Chunsoft is a developer, that's actually just a little bit older than I am. It's 39 years old. They'll be celebrating their 40th birthday in April. And in that time, they have developed a remarkable array of games, including ones that many of our listeners probably played. And these include the first five Dragon Quest games, the Danganronpa series, the Zero Escape series, many, many more. You might think, wait a minute, Enix created the Dragon Quest games. Ah, that was the publisher. The developer, though, was just Chunsoft back then. No Spike. That was added later. But I would argue that based on their output, their most prolific series is the Mystery Dungeon series. And that's for a very interesting reason. Because unlike many RPG series that, you know, develop their own identity, this one originated as a crossover game with Dragon Quest IV called Torneko's Great Adventure. So Torneko was the merchant in Dragon Quest IV, super, super popular character. If you saw the character, you definitely recognize him. He's a mustachioed shopkeep. And they decided, okay, let's do a spin-off game on this. And they decided to go in a very different direction from the gameplay of the Dragon Quest series. So we're going to be talking about that in just a sec. The funny thing is, I would say the vast majority of the games in this series are all crossover-based. And honestly, it's truly stunning the different properties that the Mystery Dungeon series has adapted. But rather than talk about all of them, because we don't want this to be a four-hour podcast, we're just going to be talking about some of the most popular and well-known entries of the series, and then we're going to be talking about the most recent entry. So Ben, the very first entry in this series was Dragon Quest / Mystery Dungeon. So what was it exactly?
Yeah, so the first one is Torneko's Great Adventure. So the setup for this is that Torneko, the merchant party member from Dragon Quest IV, is entering into dungeons to find loot to sell in his shop, and the developers at Spike are at Chunsoft. Particularly Koichi Nakamura, who was the head of Chunsoft at the time, and I believe still today, he was inspired by an old PC game called Rogue. So if anybody's familiar, any listeners are familiar with Rogue, it was a really early PC game, has like ASCII graphics. And the main thing about that game is it's an RPG where everything is turn-based. So movement is turn-based and interacting with items is takes place in turns. And, you know, everything that you do when you move around on the map or move around in dungeons is all turn-based. And enemies move as you do. And so they really liked that idea and they wanted to apply that to the Dragon Quest framework. So they figured, you know, Tornico is a really popular character. He's really recognizable and marketable. So they figured, well, we'll take him and we'll put him in this. And because of his background as a merchant, they figured that it would kind of make sense for him to be going into these dungeons and dealing with all these, you know, picking up all these items and filling his inventory. And so that's kind of how the series was born. And, you know, that key idea of finding a bunch of items and then how those items interact, that's like the key thing that is carried over throughout all the Mystery Dungeon games and kind of what makes them interesting in the world of roguelike games, even still today.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to me because, I mean, Rogue was released in 1980 and it was PC only. It was never adapted to consoles, to the best of my knowledge. So because Japan especially was so console focused in terms of their gaming, I mean, they did have PCs, but it was very much a minority as compared to the United States and the rest of the West in terms of their gaming culture. So it didn't really make a splash over there until years and years and years later. It's fascinating to me that they looked at this and said, oh, this is an interesting gameplay mechanic that nobody else is really doing, that no one else is really using, and it fits into the RPG genre in a way that makes sense, but it's fresh and it's new and it's different, and every single run is completely different from the last. So it's interesting to me that 1993, 13 years later, they decided to adapt this game into something that is very much a in the JRPG genre, and featuring, you know, classic characters from these series. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that especially when you're looking at like the lineage or background of developers in Japan, particularly developers of like some of the early classic RPGs, you know, PC gaming wasn't super, super huge in Japan, but a lot of the people who would go on to develop some of the classic RPGs, you know, Japanese RPGs we think of today, they were doing some PC gaming, and a lot of their influences came from there because you had like either you were gaming on PCs or you were gaming in arcades. And so a lot of the Japanese developers we know today started in arcades, right? But you do have that you know, smaller group that were experimenting with PC games, a lot of times even still in English, and, you know, kind of trying to, you know, work their way through the language barrier and play these games on PCs. And then there were a few companies that would adapt games, like Wizardry got really big in Japan, for example, and, you know, Japanese developers now are the ones who make Wizardry games.
Up until very recently, this was still the case. I mean, I'm reading a book right now. I'm not going to say the name of it because I think we might be doing a random book club on it a little bit later. But it was talking about bringing over a very popular indie game. But at the time, it was PC only. And that was a big problem because they had to figure out, they had to not just localize the game, but they also needed to port it over to other systems if they wanted to even be remotely a smash. And this was in 2015.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's that small, you know, those small, really dedicated group of people and who were, you know, experimenting with PC games in the earlier to mid 80s in Japan. A lot of those people, because they were so dedicated, they would go on to work in game development. And because, you know, arcades don't really, you know, we didn't see a lot of the game design elements that we would find in RPGs and arcades. So a lot of the people who were like, oh, drawn to making RPGs did have a little bit of background in PC games. But the benefit of that is that, you know, the market in Japan, you know, they weren't, the gaming audience wasn't super used to, you know, those games that originated on PCs in the early 80s. So they were bringing those kind of ideas and game design concepts to consoles. And I think Shirin and Tornico, the Mystery Dungeon series in general, is a really good example of that, of taking those kind of concepts that were developed really early in PC gaming and then bringing them to a console audience And then maybe a little bit more simplified and stripped down way, but still maintaining the really addictive and engaging elements of those games.
It's funny because, I mean, nowadays, just about everything is a roguelike. It's very, very popular. It's a hugely popular genre. Yep. And I mean, Tim was on here a few weeks ago reviewing Under the Castle for the Playdate, which is a roguelike, very much inspired by Rogue. It's turn-based, an RPG, all of that stuff. This is in many ways a very traditional adaptation of Rogue. Yep. Like you said, it's turn-based, so everything is, you know, turn. Dungeons are randomly generated, or I guess nowadays it would be procedurally generated.
Yep.
And randomized, so all items are in different locations. And the big one, the thing that really exemplifies Rogue, is permadeath. So when you die, you lose all of your items, you lose all of your progress, and you go back to level one. Mm-hmm. So the form of progress, rather than getting items and becoming stronger, it's experiential based. You need to improve your skills rather than get abilities to advance. And clearly this resonated with Japanese audiences because there are like 50 of these things. It's fascinating to me that this series specifically became such a clearly a huge hit. And I can't really think of any other series in like JRPG series that I can think of that in the SNES and PlayStation era that really does this, aside from Mystery Dungeon.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of a few examples. Konami had a few experiments with roguelike games early on. They had a game called Cave Noir for the Game Boy in 1991, and then they later had a game that was for the PlayStation, and I'm blanking on the name right now, but you play as like a red-haired kid, and you go up a tower, and has some monster collecting elements and stuff to it. And so there was a couple, you know, other companies that were kind of working on these ideas, but for the most part, nobody was really, really doing it. And so, you know, I think Chunsoft really identified like, hey, you know, they had some experience, like I said, Koichi Nakamura and a couple other developers at Chunsoft had messed with around with Rogue and NetHack a little bit. And they were like, you know, this is a really appealing concept. And, you know, we really enjoy it. And it kind of has that, you know, try and try again aspect that you would find in like the arcades. And so, you know, they were just wanted to figure out how they could adapt it, you know, to the console market. And Dragon Quest, you know, had already kind of taken the basic framework of those PC RPGs like Wizardry or Ultima and adapted it to consoles. So it made a lot of sense to do you know, the same thing and use the kind of things that they'd already developed for Dragon Quest to bring roguelikes to, you know, the Super Nintendo.
Also, if you want to introduce a new genre, especially in Japan, especially in that time period, it's not a bad idea to slap Dragon Quest on the title.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's going to sell a few games.
Yeah, they did it many times, you know, Dragon Quest Monsters, when they wanted to do more, you know, creature collecting RPGs or, you know, there's a long lineage of Dragon Quest spinoffs. So, you know, and this is one of the earliest ones. And, you know, I think that they, you know, because they had that relationship to Dragon Quest, it made a lot of sense for them.
Yeah, because they didn't own the rights to Dragon Quest, Enix did, right. But they were the developers, the sole developers of the game up to that point. So especially with their name on the box, there was a certain level of authenticity. This wasn't just a cash-in. This was right. The developer of Dragon Quest making a new Dragon Quest game.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, that kind of leads us into what would become the Shirin the Wanderer series because, you know, so Tornico's in 1993. And then, you know, after it comes out and it sells pretty well and, you know, there's a lot of fans, develops an audience for this type of game, Chunsoft wants to continue, you know, with what they had worked on in the past. But, you know, they don't own the rights to Dragon Quest, so they're not able to just use Tornico and use all the monsters and use all the other Dragon Quest trappings that they had used in Tornico. So they
what
decided,
do you do?
Yep. What do you do? Well, you got to make your own series, right? So 1995, they released Shirin the Wanderer, which has basically very similar mechanics to the first Tornico game. But it takes
It's actually labeled as, I cannot pronounce Japanese, but Fushigo New Dungeon 2.
Yep, Fushigo New Dungeon 2, yep.
Mm-hmm. So they did label it as the direct sequel.
That's right, yep.
Without the Dragon Quest connection. So, and also, they published it. They didn't just develop it, so they published it. So they owned this. This was their property. This with this title, this became the mainline series of Mystery Dungeon, despite the fact that the first Mystery Dungeon had nothing to do with it.
Yep, that's correct. That's correct. And it's you know, it's really Chunsoft's baby, because it's like the first time they were, you know, they completely own, you know, the rights to the whole thing. And this is like putting all of their, you know, everything they learned and throughout working on Dragon Quest and working on Tornico, put a lot of love and heart into this game. And, you know, it kind of established, you know, what Chunsoft would later be today. Because they had so much success with the first Shirin and then a couple other things that they did at the time. But it was huge for them. And, you know, Shirin, you know, it rather than having the kind of West, like, you know, the mix of the manga, you know, aesthetic style of Toriyama, that Toriyama lent to Dragon Quest. And rather than having that otherwise like Western kind of sword and sorcery setting, they opted for a more traditional Japanese setting. So Shirin is like a wandering, you know, samurai type figure. And the setting is very like traditional Japanese setting with, you know, the, you know, peasants and feudal lords and mystical, you know, yokai and things like that. Involved in the plot and in the setting and everything. And the monster designs all kind of take that style too. So you have a lot of like the cute style monsters that you kind of have a little bit of Dragon Quest influence, but they're maybe a little more grounded or related to wildlife you'd find in Japan or mystical creatures that are part of Japanese folklore. And so that kind of allowed them to have the series, you know, have its own identity, but still feel like Mystery Dungeon, right?
Yeah, and I mean, despite that, despite the fact that they were making their own, their new thing, I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, it's a direct sequel, but also there's still DNA that connects the two. Like, I've read that Sugiyama was the composer, everyone's favorite non-problematic composer.
Yeah, yep, yep, he was the composer for the first one, yeah. And then his tracks, so then some Sugiyama tracks were used for most of the rest of the series up until six has no, you know, Sugiyama tracks, but, or even influences from Sugiyama tracks. But yeah, a lot of the series.
Don't imagine that many people are crying about that.
No, and actually the soundtrack in Shirin 6 is super good. So,
not good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they started churning these things out. Very, very quickly, as a matter of fact. They following year they released a Game Boy version, which that's what you did back in those days, and very smartly too, because the Game Boy was super popular. So they turned out a Game Boy version. They released a BS Shirin the Wanderer, that would be a Satillaview version. Then we move into a very interesting thing. Actually, before I jump into that, I'm gonna ask you another question about this. How do they differentiate the Dragon Quest entries from the mainline Shirin entries? Like, are there any differences between the two games in terms of its gameplay style?
Yeah, so I would say that for the crossover games, the Dragon Quest ones are the most similar with Shirin. So, you know, a lot of the differences are aesthetic. You know, so you've got Dragon Quest monsters from the series in the game. You have equipment, you know, items and different things like that from the game, from the Dragon Quest games will appear in the Tornico games. And then the storylines are often a lot more influenced by, you know, the types of things you would see in Dragon Quest. And often, you know, take place either, you know, before or sometime after Dragon Quest IV. So most of the differences are like story, narrative, aesthetic differences. The later crossover games that we'll get into in a bit definitely make more mechanical changes. But for the most part, you know, Tornico games are pretty similar to the Shirin series in a lot of ways, just because they kind of were born from that same time period and same DNA. So they iterate, you know, there's a little bit of iteration that the following Tornico games would have on the original, and then, you know, the Sheeran games would then maybe branch out from Sheeran, but they have the same base foundation, and so that's why they're about the most similar, I would say.
That makes complete sense. Well, let's move into a place that differences started to be introduced, and that's because they partnered with a new company, another very famous RPG company, Squaresoft. So this would have been, let's see here, this was in 1997, hot year for Squaresoft. They released something, can't remember what it was. I think it might be big at the moment we're talking about this. They released Final Fantasy VII, and Final Fantasy was always popular in Japan, but here in the West, the demand started, it just exploded after Final Fantasy VII. People couldn't get enough Final Fantasy. And thankfully, there were some games that they could release here. And that's because Squaresoft partnered and they created Mystery Dungeon games starring chocobos. And I suspect that some people listening to this are like, oh, yeah, because at least one of these games existed on the PlayStation and it was pretty popular at the time. And that is Chocobo Mystery Dungeon. Well, Chocobo Dungeon 2, technically. They released the sequel without the first one. It's weird.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So Chocobo Dungeon is a series that has continued, maybe not to this day. No, to this day. The last one was a few years ago, but it still exists.
Yep.
And they changed some stuff around. They played with the formula a little bit, and especially because it starred chocobos, it was a Final Fantasy spinoff, but it wasn't a Final Fantasy game in terms of its difficulty. They, from what I've read, they de-aged it essentially.
Yeah. It's I would say the Chocobo's Dungeon series for Mystery Dungeon games, it is on the easier side. I would say the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon games, which we'll get to later, are probably the easiest and most beginner friendly. After that would be Chocobo's Dungeon. And so the first Chocobo's Dungeon was created in cooperation between Square and Chunsoft. And Koichi Nakamura did supervise the development of Chocobo's Dungeon, the first one, to ensure that the Mystery Dungeon elements were carried over faithfully, that it really felt like a Mystery Dungeon series game, and then also, you know, blended in those Final Fantasy elements that one would expect. So, you know, you've got, you know, Chocobo as your main character. Then you've got, you know, Final Fantasy series monsters as the enemies in the game. And then all the items and equipment are, you know, Final Fantasy series staples. So you know, Chocobo pick up books that allow you to cast spells like Fyra and Thundaga and, you know, all that. And, you know, the most interesting kind of Final Fantasy element that they brought into this game was the ATB system. So, you know, it's a little different in this, obviously, because, you know, the whole game is turn-based. Every action is turn-based. And if you were to require that the ATV bar fill up before you took an action every time, that would, like, grind the pace of these games to a halt, right? So instead of doing that, what they did was there's still an ATV bar. And so when you take actions, when that bar is full, then they will be more potent or more powerful. So if you attack with the ATB bar full, then you'll do more damage, for example. And so that's kind of an interesting little wrinkle that changes up the way that you would play a Mystery Dungeon game. When you have that bar filling up in real time, contrasting with the otherwise turn-based nature of the game. And it's, you know, tuned down to be a little more approachable and cute and everything. It's a really unique experience. And at that time, you know, other than Tornico, you know, there really weren't any crossovers. And this is the first time that they really started a Mystery Dungeon crossover where they sought specifically to take elements from an already existing series and adapt them into the foundation they already had with Sheeran and Tornico. And so I think that's what makes it really interesting to look at today.
It's so clever. It's like, if you, just from looking at it from a purely business point of view, like they literally had Mystery Dungeon games starring Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest, which were two at the time, two of the biggest RPG franchises, and were directly opposed to each other because they were owned by two different companies. Things change.
Yeah.
But this was a bridge between the two. That must have been huge. Less so in the West, because no one knew what was going on. But I imagine in Japan, it probably made quite a splash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it sold quite well in Japan, the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was immediately followed up the following year by Chocobo Dungeon 2, which mm-hmm. we got as mm-hmm. Chocobo Dungeon 2, which yeah. I imagine, especially in those days, was rather confusing for some people at Blockbuster Video looking for the first yeah. one because they enjoyed the second one so much.
Yeah, I'm sure it was confusing for a lot of reasons, because I believe that Chocobo's Dungeon 2 is the first Mystery Dungeon game to release in the West as well. So not only do we have no, you know, frame of reference for why it's Chocobo's 2, we also don't know why the dungeon is a 2 either. Yeah. We don't know what's Mystery Dungeon. Nobody has any idea. Yeah. And so it's an interesting game to be the first one to be released in the West, because this is the, I believe, also the first Mystery Dungeon that had no direct involvement from Chunsoft. So at this point, Square Enix was making the Chocobo's Dungeon series on their own. Yeah. And, you know, taking everything that they had, you know, learned and that Chunsoft had helped them with for the first game, but not actually having any involvement from them. But it's still technically part of the series because it is a sequel to the first one. Mm. And, this one the main thing that separates it from Chocobo's Dungeon 1 is that you almost always have an AI controlled party member with you, partner with you at all times. And it also removed the ATB system that they added to Chocobo's Dungeon, the first one. And it plays a lot more, you know, traditional Mystery Dungeon style because of that. And it's, I would say it's a little easier because of that as well than the first one. And the storyline is definitely more targeted towards children. It's very cute and it's very like light. But it is a great game. You know, I think a lot of people played it and really loved it. And I think for introducing like Western players who probably have no experience at all at that time with roguelikes, especially on consoles, it's a good one to start with. I could see why they thought they would localize that, as the first one to come over. Though I do think calling it Chocobo's Dungeon 2 was weird.
Very baffling decision, but
yeah.
You know, whatever. Well, the series kept trucking along. I say trucking along. It's more like zooming down the right raceway with multiple entries, both in the Sharon series, Sharon series and Tornico, lots of them. And eventually it took about, a few years later, they landed another rather big RPG series to adapt into the Mystery Dungeon games, and that was Pokemon, which at this time, Pokemon was humongous when it was released, and it continued in popularity, and at this time it was very, very big in games. It started to be released for they were out of the Game Boy by this point. We were at the Game Boy Advance. So the very first one was Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Red and Blue Rescue Team, because you can't have a Pokemon game unless you have two of them. And it was released in 2006. Developed in 2005, but it very much lived up to the series name, both in terms of what Mystery Dungeon delivered and what Pokemon delivered. So how did there have been a lot of Pokemon games in this series since then, but how did this one, and I guess future entries, differ from the mainline series?
Yeah, so Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, I think, really established, I think it of any game in the Mystery Dungeon series, these games are the ones that established like the concept of Mystery Dungeon in the minds of the Western audience, right? If most people know what Mystery Dungeon means, they know it from Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. Mm-hmm. And I think that just speaks to, you know, the popularity of the Pokemon brand and also the quality of these crossover games. Red and Blue Rescue Team, it's a really interesting take on Mystery Dungeon because it does like sand down a lot of the hard edges that the rest of the games in the series have. So, you no longer, if you fall in a dungeon, you no longer revert back to level one, because they wanted to keep that continuous growth and like you know, progression and evolution loop that you have in Pokemon. They wanted to maintain that in the Pokemon Industry Dungeon series. So your characters will, you know, keep their levels even if you die in a dungeon, and you learn new abilities as you level up, just like in a regular Pokemon game. And so that's one thing that makes the series a little more approachable compared to the other ones, and, you know, has that, maintains that Pokemon element in that way. And then the other major thing that it does is that there is a monster, you know, the monster collecting aspect of Pokemon, which is so huge.
Gotta catch them all.
Yep. Was brought into Pokemon Mystery Dungeon as well. So in the series, you can, you know, if you defeat other Pokemon in the dungeons, because, you know, that's the other thing about this series is that you play as Pokemon and then all the enemies are Pokemon. And the narrative conceit is actually really interesting. You are a human being who has been transported to the Pokemon world and are in the body of a Pokemon, which is like very high concept. You know, you'll form a friendship with a partner Pokemon, and they kind of take you through the story of the game. And so, you know, as you defeat other Pokemon in dungeons, or you know, depending on the game and the series, complete, you know, quests or requests for other Pokemon, then those Pokemon will want to become friends with you and join your group, and then you can bring them into your party with you to explore the dungeons. So those are the main ways that it differs from the other games in the series. And then the other thing is that it has a renewed focus on storylines. So, you know, the other Mystery Dungeons like have stories, but they're not really it's not a narrative focused series really. But the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon is actually super narrative focused. There's a lot of like cutscenes and dialogue. And that's also one of the things that the fans really love about the Mystery Dungeon series is the storylines. And part of that is because Shinichiro Tomie, who is most famous for working on a lot of the visual novels that Chunsoft developed early on, he is the writer for all the storylines in the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon series. And so this gave him an opportunity to really like flex his muscles, I guess, and write some really compelling and interesting character-driven stories in the Pokemon universe, which is very different than what you would normally see in a Pokemon game.
Mm. One of the things that it seems that these games really do, like you mentioned, they aren't super super deep narratives, but very rewarding narratives, especially for those who like to, I guess, meet and re-meet characters and visit old friends and things like that. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes with Shurin 6. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are so many of these games. There are almost as many games as there are Pokemon. maybe not quite, but close. Gotta catch them all. And we can't catch them all because we are in the West, which is one of the drawbacks of this series, unfortunately, for us, is that while we have select entries in the series, we do not have official releases for many of them.
That's right.
As per usual, fan translations have stepped in to fill that void to varying degrees of success. What would you say are some of the better fan translations in this series?
Yeah, so actually the nice thing about Mystery Dungeon, especially Shirin the Wanderer subseries in particular, is that there is a really dedicated fan community for both documenting the games, you know, writing wikis and everything, and then also translating. So there is a person who goes by the name Shark online, and they are the main fan translator of Shirin the Wanderer games. So they've worked on Shirin the Wanderer 2, they worked on Shirin the Wanderer 4, and also the second Shirin the Wanderer DS game, which we did not get over here.
There are a lot of remakes too.
Mm-hmm, yes, and that one is a remake. Those three were worked on by them. And then there's also another group that's working on the Asuka spinoff that was on the Dreamcast. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely recommend, you know, any of the translations done by Shark. They're all really excellent. And they, you know, they do a really good job of like trying to keep the names of items and the names of like mechanics and stuff consistent throughout the games that they translate. Because that's one thing about the games that were brought over is that most of the time they got brought over by different localization companies. And so a lot of those terms and monster names and character names even sometimes would change between releases because you had different companies working on the English versions. And so they do a really good job trying to keep them consistent. So yeah, Sheeran 2 or Sheeran 4 are both, you know, really good translations by them.
I really, really, it's a personal thing, I think. I just really like when a spinoff is so successful that it creates its own series completely separate from the original, and to the point where it actually eclipses the original series in many ways. I would argue that maybe Mystery Dungeon hasn't quite eclipsed Dragon Quest, but it has eclipsed the where it started. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you and I could be here all night talking about the sheer number of games here. But I think one of the best ways to really get a feel for this is to dive into the latest one, which came out a few days ago, Sheeran the Wanderer, The Mystery Dungeon of Serpent Coil Island. So you recently reviewed this for the site. Mm-hmm. Not to mince words, but you absolutely loved this game.
Yep. It's a fantastic game. I really, really loved it. I think that it is, you know, probably now the best entry point for the series. If you've never played, you know, a Sheeran the Wanderer game before and you want to get into the series, then this is a great place to start. I think even if you've never played any Mystery Dungeon game before, this is a great place to start as well. It is a little tougher than some of the spinoff games, but they do a lot of really good things to make it much more approachable for new players and still maintain like the challenge and, you know, engaging aspects of the game to keep you invested and wanting to come back. I really loved it. It's just, you know, for a little bit of background, you know, the last mainline Sheeran the Wanderer release that we saw in the West was Sheeran the Wanderer 5, which is called the Tower of Fortune and the Dice of Fate. Mm-hmm. And that game was originally released in Japan for the DS in 2010. So we didn't get that game until 2015 with its expanded PlayStation Vita release. And then that release would later get ported to the Nintendo Switch and on PC in 2020. So while it may not feel like it's been a super long time since we've got anything Sheeran the Wanderer, the reality is that the last time there was a Sheeran game was in a truly new Sheeran game was in 2010. So it's been a very long time coming for this
years.
Game.
Mm-hmm. Longer than the time between making Rogue and the first Mystery Dungeon game, as a matter of fact.
Yep. And so that's a huge gap. So especially for Japanese players, you know, they were really, you know, wanting a new game in the series. And, you know, even though I think a lot of people probably have just recently discovered Sheeran the Wanderer with the release on Switch and PC, you know, it is still built on the foundations of a DS game from 2010. And a lot has changed both, you know, for the Mystery Dungeon series, for Chunsoft, and also for roguelikes in general in that time.
Oh, God,
right?
Yes.
So, you know, even in 2015, when the game first came out on Vita in the West, you know, there were a lot more roguelikes, but it wasn't, you know, they weren't as like huge as they are now, right? Where you have games like Hades getting like Game of the Year nominations, right? And you have, you know, a bunch of other different games that are, you know, a lot of indie games these days are bringing in roguelike elements, right?
So yeah, it's an incredibly popular genre right now, but like that would have been 2 years after Spelunky was released, which very much popularized, I mean, it's not an RPG and it's not turn-based, but it popularized roguelike games in the eyes of a lot of gamers. So between Spelunky and now, that is a considerable change in gaming attitudes. Since then, it's become, I mean, I would argue roguelikes are not, they're not novelties anymore. They are, it's a genre.
Okay.
Absolutely. So this particular game, Sheeran, this sub series in this series, why don't you tell us a little bit about it? So who is Shirin? Who are his friends? And why is Shirin going into these mystery dungeons?
Yeah, so Shirin is, he's a wanderer. He's basically been wandering all of his life. One interesting thing about the Shirin series is it's kind of like the Ease series in that the various games and that they, you know, like each entry will pick another point in his life and another adventure in his life. And it may not be, you know, chronologically in the same order that the games release. So like in Shirin 1, he's like, you know, a teenager. And then in Shirin 2, he's 10 years old. So it kind of jumps around at various points of it in his life and various adventures. But throughout all of that, he has a companion who's a talking weasel named Kappa. And and he's very cute and he has a lot of like witty and snarky things to say, depending on what's happening in the story. And then he also has a couple other companions that he meets. So one in particular is Asuka, who's a wandering swordswoman. And she is a reoccurring character that's appeared in quite a few Shirin games and also has gotten her own spinoff game. That was on the Dreamcast. I think I mentioned that earlier. But she returns in this one as well. So this one kind of takes place a little bit in the middle. So Shirin's, I think he's in his late teens, like probably 17 or 18 in this game. And he's had a few adventures. He already met Asuka. And, you know, he's got a few, you know, dungeon crawls under his belt. But it's not the latest one in the series. So it's not the old, he's not at his oldest. And so in this game, the, you know, setup is that, world that Shirin inhabits, which is, you know, based on Japan, is going through a drought and, you know, this horrible drought, you know, the peasants are saying, oh, it's because we've angered the gods. And, you know, nobody really knows what the origin of it is. But then there's a rumor that this group of islands, at the center of which is Serpent Coil Island, is unaffected by the drought. So, you know, Shirin hears about this and hears that along with these rumors, there's tale of treasures to be found there. So what's a wanderer to do except go check it out? So he goes to Serpent Coil Island, and then as he's going, he gets a vision of this young girl who is trapped in the belly of this beast called Jakaku. And Jakaku is at the top of the mountain at the center of Serpent Coil Island, and she pleads with Shirin to come and rescue her. And that's pretty common. And a lot of the games, you know, there'll be some either damsel in distress or some other person that needs rescuing. And then that gives you extra motivation to want to see the dungeon through to his end. So unlike a lot of the other wanderers and rogues and different characters you meet, Shirin has a heart of gold and his motivations are often more selfless than the characters around him. Mm-hmm. And so that's what brings you to Serpent Coil Island. And then when you get there, because of all these rumors, there's all kinds of other groups of people converging on the island, trying to get the treasure, trying to get to the heart of whatever magic is safeguarding the island from the drought. And that's kind of what you're thrown in the middle of. And you got to deal with all these different characters that have their own competing motivations on the island while doing your dungeon crawling and saving the girl and your visions.
Okay. One of the things that I noticed about your review, that it's funny, we were talking about this series and how it's evolved over the years in so many different ways from so many different properties and IPs. Mm-hmm. It seems like this game, more so than any other in recent memory, really does go back to the well in terms of the heart of the Mystery Dungeon series. How does it do that in comparison to, say, Shirin 5?
Yeah, so, you know, the main way I would say that it takes that kind of back-to-basics approach, which is one thing that developers said in interviews before the game came out, is that they really wanted to do is kind of have that core identity of what made Shirin 1, the first game in the Shirin the Wanderer series, so special, and kind of go back to that and then keep the elements that they felt were the best, and then kind of get rid of a lot of the elements that had been added on over the years that they didn't feel like necessarily added the most to the experience. So, you know, one of the ways that they did that is that if you play Shirin 5, then you'll know that at the starting village, there's like all kinds of different services and characters that can provide you with different options and different, you know, items you can buy and, you know, storage and the bank and a bunch of different companions you can recruit. And there's just all of these mechanics that are open to you at the beginning, which makes sense because it's, you know, it's the fifth game in the series. You know, these are all things that they've introduced over time. And so a lot of veteran players would expect those things to be available right at the start. But the problem with that is that it can be really overwhelming for new players. I remember when I first played Shirin 5 in 2015, I was really confused about a lot of those mechanics just because I didn't really have any frame of reference. We didn't get a lot of the prior games in the series. So I was like, wow, this is a lot of stuff to wrap your head around. And it can be kind of confusing and daunting for a new player, right? Mm-hmm. So in Shirin 6, they do a really interesting thing where all that, those mechanics are all still in the game, a lot of them, not all of them, but many of them. But you don't unlock them until you get far enough in the game. You know, you complete the initial run of the story dungeon, and then as you complete more side quests and things, more of those mechanics will be available to you. So it does a really good job of giving you like the stripped down, pure experience of Shirin the Wanderer without a lot of those extra mechanics at the beginning, and then we'll give them to you, you know, piecemeal as you get further and further into the game. And then you can kind of master those new elements as you go, one at a time, which I think is a really great way of like introducing the player to what can be a very complex game. But instead of throwing everything at you at once, it's like, okay, here's something. And then once you've mastered that, here's another thing. And then once you've mastered that, here's another thing. And that's really key to the identity of the series, is like learning about, you know, what all the items do, learning about what the, you know, the various enemy behaviors, and learning about how things can kind of combine in a way to get you out of difficult situations or give you an advantage over the enemies so that you can overcome the challenges the game presents. And this game, I think, does a really great job of requiring the player to master those elements and mechanics without overwhelming them all at once.
I mean, there is possibly another excuse, which is 14 years. You could argue that at that point, the series was dead. And by the rules of this series, when you die, you have to go back to the start again. So
That is a very good point. It is, you know, there's like a meta element there. I think you're right. Yeah.
So, yeah, they had to get rid of all of the upgrades, all of the changes, everything. They just needed to go right back to the beginning because that's what you do with a roguelike. When you die, you have to go back to the start again.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that is a really good way of looking at it, I think.
Mm. Okay, we've talked a lot about this, and we say turn-based, but I'm very curious. Can you tell us in more detail how the combat works in this game? Because it's turn-based, so, you know, you move and the monsters move, and I believe it's at the same time. So how does that work in game?
Yeah, so essentially when you're moving throughout the dungeon, normally whenever you take a step, you know, that get the enemies can also take a step, and these turns all play out like simultaneously, right? So if you're like, let's say you're in one of the dungeon rooms and there's an enemy like five spaces away from you. If you move one forward, they're also going to move one in some direction, right? Mm-hmm. Now, once you get right up, you know, adjacent to an enemy and then start initiating combat, that is then where it'll be more like traditional in terms of you take a turn and then the enemy will take a turn immediately after. So, you know, and then as many enemies as there are, that's how many turns it will be until your turn comes back around again. So what's really interesting about that is when you first hear, oh, well, it's all turn-based, that might make you think that the game is really slow. But because, you know, the turns are simultaneous until combat starts, then that makes everything move at a really fast pace. And there's a lot of like extra, you know, quality of life elements they've added in to make you be able to kind of speed through the dungeons until something interesting happens, like you come across an enemy or an item or an NPC or whatever, what have you. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that's kind of mainly how combat works. And so when you have a turn, unlike a traditional RPG where you get moved into a separate battle screen and then you have the things that you can do specifically in that battle that might be different than what you can do in the overworld or whatever. When in Shir and the Wanderer, you know, whatever you can do at any point in time in a dungeon is what you can do in combat and what you can do out of combat, right? So if you have an item in your inventory that, you know, heals you, you can use your turn to do that. If you want to attack the enemy, you can do that. If you have an item in your inventory that will do something to the enemies or do something to the environment or whatever, then you can choose to do that. And so, you know, what makes the game really interesting and fresh is that it makes like a lot of the encounters kind of feel like a puzzle. So you'll, you know, let's say you walk into a room and you encounter all of a sudden there's like a bunch of monsters right there. Well, then you got to look in your inventory and you got to think, well, what can I do to get me out of this situation? Can I do something that allows me to run away and heal up and then come back when I'm more prepared? Or can I do something that's going to eliminate all the monsters or give them all a status effect that's going to allow me to get past them? You know, you have so many options and all your options are limited by whatever's in your inventory at that moment. So, you know, that's kind of what makes every situation feel different and unique, because, you know, the items you have access to are random and the enemies that you're going to face are random. And so every time you go through the dungeon, you always get somewhat of a different experience.
Okay. You are very enthusiastic about items in this game, specifically what you call sacred items. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that in 5, equipment gains experience and grows stronger the more you use it. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, and that seems to be, if you're getting back to the beginning, that seems to almost run contrary to the roguelike. If you died, would it go back to zero or?
Yeah, so the way it worked in Shir and 5 is that, yes, sure. And as you used items, they would like level up and get stronger. Kind of like, you know, when you use moves in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, they also level up and get stronger. It was kind of borrowed from that system.
So it was a roguelite mechanic rather than a roguelike mechanic.
Yes, yes. And as part of that, you know, so Shir and 5 had some items called, they had an item called Undo Grass, and then they had an item called Escape Scrolls. And so these items, what they would do is if you were going to die in a dungeon, you know, if you were about to die, then you could use an escape scroll and that would take you back to the starting dungeon. You would still lose all your levels, but you would keep your entire inventory. And then the undo grass, if you died while you had that in your inventory, it would just whisk you away back to the starting area with your entire inventory. So there was a lot of mechanics that encouraged you to repeatedly, like if you got into a bad spot in a dungeon, you know, basically escape and bring in that inventory of items back with you. And so you could kind of get over multiple runs, develop this big like stockpile of items and weapons and everything. And then you would be able to use that in your further dungeon runs. And it was kind of balanced around that. So Shir and 6 does away with all of that. So now your items don't level up on use. You don't have any escape scrolls and you don't have any undo grass. So it's very difficult to like take an entire inventory of items back with you unless you actually finish a dungeon. And so that means it's a lot more focused on what you actually find on that particular dungeon run, as opposed to the items that you've brought back with you over the course of like 10 or 15 runs. And so that makes it, you know, that fits more, at least in my opinion, a little bit more in with the idea of a roguelike in general, because it's really yes. Like, what are the things that I'm going to get on this run and how do I, you know, what I take what I've learned from my past runs and then apply that to what I have now and get by with what I've got, as opposed to just like building up this big stockpile of powerful weapons over a longer period of time.
Yeah. And,
and the sacred items, sorry, that's what you started with, and I didn't get to that part. But the sacred items are like randomized loot that has special properties. So they're like kind of like in like a Diablo, for example, where you get like a purple item or a orange item that has like a really cool properties or really powerful effects. You can find
items with modifiers.
Yeah, items with modifiers. And they have like special modifiers that make them, you know, stronger, you know, just basically in like the defensive value or attack value, or they have the modifiers that will give you like special effects. So maybe they'll make you immune to a certain type of monster's ability, or maybe they will give you increased critical chance when your HP is a certain level, or things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so those items you can randomly find in a dungeon, and they can completely change your run. So if you find one of those, that can be the difference between like success and failure. And so that feels very, you know, there's a big element of randomness to it, but it feels very rewarding when you're able to get one and then finish the dungeon and then bring it back with you. And then from there, you can make it stronger.
I think that one of the reasons why roguelikes have become so popular over the last 14 or so years is because of something that all developers deal with and have to deal with, which is replay value. Mm-hmm. By introducing roguelike mechanics into a game, you are maybe not exponentially increasing the replay value, but you are dramatically increasing it because every run is different and it becomes, you have to build your skills every time. So it's once you've seen everything, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've seen everything because you still don't have the skills to effectively get through it. It seems to me that Sheeran 6, from what I've read here, will have you playing for quite some time, even though you have technically, quote unquote, completed the game.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I put about 40 hours into the game, you know, for the review, and that was completing, there's three story dungeons. So after you complete the first story dungeon, you'll see the credits roll, but there's still two additional story dungeons after that. And I'm not going to get into any of the details of what's in there, but that's like the conclusion of the story. But then after that, there's still a bunch of dungeons in the post game for you to complete. So I've completed quite a few of those post game dungeons. And there's one very, very hard dungeon that has 99 floors, and I've gotten to that, but haven't finished that. So I would say, you know, I could play this game for another 40, 50, 60 hours, before I were to complete all the content. And I think if you aren't super experienced with the series, then it could take you, you know, even longer than that if you wanted. But the beauty of a game like this is that you are able to have a really satisfying and fulfilling experience even without like fully completing the content. So even doing that first initial story dungeon, if that takes you, you know, 10 to 20 hours to do, it's still super rewarding to do that and finally get to the end. And then there's so much content after that for you to do if you want to do it. And I think that's like really the best thing about this game is that they did a really good job of giving you a lot of little story hooks and side quests and reasons to want to keep playing and keep going. But you can pretty much stop at any time you want and you'll feel like you got like a full experience out of the game. But you can also play it for a really long time. The other thing is there are some really interesting like multiplayer aspects that they added to this one. So a lot of the games in the series have had like the rescue mechanic where other players can, you know, post a code online. And then if you enter that code in the rescue menu, you can attempt the dungeon to try to get to where they died. And then if you can, you know, get to where they died successfully, then they get to resume their dungeon crawl from that spot. So it's a way for players who are less experienced to kind of get a leg up from more experienced players and for more experienced players to help people out. But the new thing they added for this one is called parallel play, where you can upload a version of your dungeon run online, and then other players can then download and attempt that dungeon run. So the way that might work is, like, let's say you get into a dungeon and you found a particular set of items that's either really powerful or maybe really difficult to complete that dungeon in. Then you could say, okay, I'm going to upload this for parallel play, and then other people can try and challenge that set of parameters and that exact dungeon layout that you either just played through or are going to play through. And that also allows you to do races. So you could upload a dungeon for parallel play, and then you and your friends all attempt the same version of this dungeon and then see how long it takes you versus them. So they've added, you know, that really allows for a lot of different possibilities of, you know, possibly competitive share and play or just group or more, you know, multiplayer options for a game that is like, you know, the experience of it is single player, but allows you to kind of interact with the game with other people in a way that the series hasn't done before. And so that's, I think, one of the really cool things about this one versus the prior games in the series.
Hmm. Well, I'm very happy that you very clearly love this game and this series. And it seems like, despite the fact that there hasn't been a mainline title in 14 years, the series certainly has not been sleeping since then. There have been many, many releases in this series, and it seems like there's going to be many, many releases moving forward, too, which I suppose could lead into our discussion question. So we're going to make this about Mystery Dungeon, because this is a Mystery Dungeon-themed episode. The series was based on a crossover. Like, that was the foundation of the series is on a crossover. And since then, I would argue that its success, especially here in the West, what success it's had, is primarily based on crossovers, either with Final Fantasy or with Pokemon.
Absolutely.
It seems to me that there is a lot of potential in this series to basically cross over with just about anything. So my discussion question for you is, which RPG series, or alternatively video game series in general, would you like to see used for a crossover in the Mystery Dungeon series?
Yeah, so this is a really good discussion question. It made me think a lot about both what the series has done in the past and also what it could do. And so I, you know, what I kind of landed on was that I think the best thing that the series could cross over with next would be Shin Megami Tensei. And the reason why is, number one, they've already done, Chunsoft has already worked with Atlus on a crossover. So they did make a couple Etrian Odyssey Mystery Dungeon crossover games. And the interesting thing about those games is they focused a lot on like the party building aspect of Etrian Odyssey and bringing that into Mystery Dungeon. And that's also an element that you have in Shin Megami Tensei. But you also have in Shin Megami Tensei the element of creature collecting like you have in the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon series, right? So I think it would be really cool to combine those two elements in a Mystery Dungeon crossover game. We really haven't seen that thus far. And the other thing that makes Shin Megami Tensei really interesting is the demon negotiation. And so I think that would be a really interesting way to implement those creature mechanics, collecting mechanics in a Mystery Dungeon game. So rather than, you know, the way that you recruit other monsters in Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, you would actually have to negotiate with demons in a Mystery Dungeon game. Give them, maybe you have to give them one of your most powerful items in your inventory in order to recruit them. And maybe you can recruit demons in a dungeon, but then you lose that party at the conclusion of the dungeon, or if you die, right?
Oh yeah.
And so that would make a really interesting, you know, risk reward push and pull kind of you know, setup that really makes the roguelike games really fun to have, like, oh well, in this dungeon, you know, I got really lucky and I came across this demon, but in order to recruit them, I had to give him my most powerful sword in my inventory and then have to deal with that for the rest of your run. I just think that would be a really, really cool crossover idea they could do.
I think so too. That does seem pretty cool. I haven't played this series at all, to be completely honest. However, it seems to me, based on some footage, like I watched some gameplay footage and things of some of the games in the series, and it seems like most of them are on like a grid-based system, like roguelikes are. And it struck me that this will never happen in a million years because Nintendo would never let one of their franchises be worked on by another company like this, except they have lately. I don't think they would do this. This is a dead series. But last year for Retro Encounter, I finally got to play and talk about Star Tropics again. I love Star Tropics, and the first one really held up, the second one less so, but Star Tropics is already on a grid. It's almost a grid-based combat system, where Mike Jones, the main character, has to move square by square by square, jumping, and the enemies are less restrained, but I feel like this kind of thing would work really well for a Star Tropics game, not necessarily in the Mystery Dungeons series, but utilizing many of the ideas from it, because my least favorite part of Star Tropics are the Dragon Quest overworld segments, mm-hmm. where it literally looks like a Dragon Quest game. I think the most interesting things are the dungeon diving, and you could totally lean into that and make it much more turn-based and add roguelike elements. And I think you could make something very interesting with Star Tropics.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, Jonah. You know, I've never played Star Tropics, but I have seen videos and gameplay and stuff of the game. And, I think you're right. It has that isometric kind of top-down perspective. And there's, it's heavily dungeon. It's kind of like Legend of Zelda, right? With like the dungeon crawling and stuff.
It's very similar to Legend. It's like Legend of Zelda if Link was wearing like one of the boots you have to wear if you break your foot. like that's basically what Star Tropics is. It's like, yeah. It's slower and more methodical, but it certainly uses the heart system. And yeah. I think Star Tropics is a game that has so much. It's so 90s. It's such a Japanese version of Americans. But it's charming and it's fun, and I really would like to see it come back. And I've thought about how would you do it if you were to bring it back. How would you do it? And I think roguelike mechanics are how you'd have to do it. And I think it could be quite an interesting game.
Yeah, I think it's a really great idea. Yeah, you take that kind of the best elements of Star Tropics, which are the dungeon crawling, and then. What's the new, Nintendo, I feel like, is always like, well, we're not going to return to a series unless we have a new idea for it, right? And like roguelike mechanics is like a really new idea, not just for this, for that series, but also for Nintendo in general, because they really don't make
a lot of roguelikes
games like that. Yeah.
I can't think of a Nintendo roguelike, actually. Well, aside from some games that are modded, but.
Yeah. I guess the Splatoon 3 just got DLC that's like a kind of a roguelike mode. So that's the only one I can think of. But, I think that would be a really, really cool idea. And it's a really good way to like revisit an old series that they haven't touched in forever.
Decades, literally decades at this point. Yeah. Well, I really would like to thank you for coming on and talking about this series. And for everyone out there wondering, it'll be a little while until the Mystery Dungeon series primer comes out, but once
probably
it does,
a couple
it'll
weeks.
Be,
yeah.
Yeah. It'll be the same kind of, quality and look and everything as our previous. So you want to get into primers, and it will be up on the site, and you should absolutely, when it's up there, visit it. I will update if you're listening to this in the future, I will update the show notes with the link to the primer. So you could just click there. But if you're listening to it today, and by today, I mean like beginning of March, then you're going to have to wait a little while, but not too long. Don't worry. In the meantime, if you're looking for something to do, you can check out our shop. You can do so by visiting www.rpgfan.com/shop. And if you do so, absolutely check out our t-shirts and check out our various other things, our phone cases. But what I would really like you to check out is the book. We teamed up with Hyperplay RPG and we released a RPG review card collection. And it is, well, exactly that. It's a collection of our review cards. If you visit our social media, you have definitely seen our review cards. They are essentially just little summarized versions of our reviews that really break down the game in just like one quick snapshot. And this is a collection of them, over nearly 300 of them. So I love this book. I think it's so cool. And that's not just me trying to sell it. I'm generally like in love with this book. So if you would like to check that out, you can do so by visiting www.rpgfan.com/shop. Another way you can support us is to check out our past episodes of Random Encounter. Last week, we had a special emergency episode focused on Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which we're recording this the evening of the 29th. So right now, as I understand it, the RPG fan Slack is completely abandoned. you could say hello and you just hear hello, hello, hello. Nobody's there. Guess why? They're playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. And if you want to play Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, but you want to hear a little bit of podcasting about it first, check out that episode. There's no spoilers on it. Don't worry. We don't spoil any big things that may or may not happen at the end of that game. We also have other podcasts here at RPG Fan. We have Retro Encounter. Last week, we had the second part of the Dragon Quest 11 episodes. And then coming up next week, we have an episode focused on Dragon Age 2. After, I think it's a follow-up to, after, I believe they call it Oranges, because they had such a good time, they decided to jump into Dragon Age 2. So check that out. There is also Rhythm Encounter, which is RPG Fan's music podcast. Last week, we had an episode that was focused entirely on Final Fantasy VII. So that was the music of Final Fantasy VII across all versions of it. Its various sequels, movies, the prequels. There's a lot of Final Fantasy VII out there. And there is some incredible music. So check that episode out. If you'd like to get in contact with us here at Random Encounter, you can fire us off a message at podcast@rpgfan.com. I would love to hear from you. If you have any ideas for future episode themes, or if you have any ideas for discussion questions, that would be a huge load off my mind, because I have to think these things up every single week. If you have anything you'd like to share with us, fire me off a message there. You can also send me an email at jlogan@rpgfan.com. And you can also find me on Mastodon at johnolgan@mastodon.social. Ben, where can we find you online, if anywhere?
Yeah, you can email me at benloganlove@gmail.com.
Cool. And if you enjoy this podcast, please share it with your friends. You can help us get the word out there, and you can rate us on iTunes or your other podcast players of choice. You can leave us reviews. We'd love to get some reviews. So yeah, check that out. Ben, genuinely, thank you very much for joining me tonight to talk about this game series, this extraordinarily long-running game series that I honestly think a lot of people don't really know a lot about. So it's really cool that you took the time to do the podcast, and also that you took the time to write this primer.
Well, thank you, Jono, for having me. I could talk about this series for hours, so you did a really good job of reining me in, and I really appreciate that. But it's a joy for me to talk about the Mystery Dungeon series anytime, and I really hope that people will check out the review and the primer and try it for themselves.
Cool. And I would also like to thank everyone out there for listening to the podcast. Now that we're done, I think that you can put down your iPhone or whatever you're listening to it, and you can go back to playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, because I imagine that there are a lot of people who are currently taking a break from Rebirth and listening to our podcast, so I very much appreciate that. But you know what? Everyone out there listening, whatever you're playing, have fun.